from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I get to go on a date to the movies with the Indianapolis Opera.
I'll carve out some time to talk with two woodworkers.
Oh, and I'll find out what's new and old at the Indianapolis Art and Antique Show. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar we call What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Indianapolis Opera wants you to be its date, and you're going to the movies. Indianapolis Opera Executive Director John Pickett and production designer Derek Toe came by to tell Sharon how they created their March 9th and 11th production, Lights, Camera, Action.
Where did this idea about lights, camera, action come from? I mean, it's so fun.
Well, I'll tell you, 5 years ago or so, the opera produced a concert, which was called Opera Center Stage. And we had
that's been 5 years?
Uh-huh.
Whoa, time flies.
And it incorporated video and live orchestra and of course, the singers, the both solo singers and the Indianapolis Opera Chorus. And we were able to get testimonials from Mario Andretti and other people and use commercials and cartoons and film clips. And we had such a great response to that that we've had the idea of let's do something that could replicate that experience. Well, Derek came involved in that process when we decided to enlarge it and was the video designer for that project and set up the live camera shots that people loved of people singing and so forth. So that time, the music really dictated the video. And when we decided to go this route, we sat down with Derek and said, let's reorganize this and let's research the films and have the video maybe dictate the program. So we've done that, and now we've collaborated to get something put together that I think is going to be tremendously excited for the opera lover and the opera novice.
Sure, because no matter what, you know, lots of people say, oh, I don't like opera, I've never heard opera, but if you've been exposed to mass media at all, you've heard opera in commercials, in films, on television shows, I mean, right? It's just surrounding us everywhere.
And I'll let Derek speak to this, but when we first started to catalog movies that had significant scenes that incorporated opera, you end up with a list of over 200, didn't you?
Yeah, initially we had about that many films, and
wow.
We started digging into them and learning about them, researching them. The internet is my best friend. I was able to talk to people out there all over the place and find websites that actually had lists of operas and movies and the books on it. And all these essays and research and all that. Mm-hmm. So I was using that, found all these clips, gathered all the clips, and then we just went through them one by one and picked out 24 of the best.
Is there a single most popular, most quoted aria or excerpt from an opera?
Probably Nostrum Dorma is a big one. That's actually going to be in our show as well. There are two movies that had that song featured in them. Prominently, I mean, Ride of the Valkyries is a big one. You hear that in a lot of movies. That's an opera, comes from an opera as well. So, those two, Madame Butterfly, I mean, has songs in it you'll hear. The Letter Duet is out there in so many movies. And
Carmen gets quoted a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The
Habanera
Duet.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. You hear a lot of O Mio Bambino Caro from Gianni Schicchi in commercials and movies.
Sure.
And so. It really was. I know I watched from afar, not too far, but our artistic director, Jim Carraher, and Derek collaborate as they winnowed this down and determined what selections. And It's been a lot of fun, and it's a nice broad range of films. It's something you'd expect, like maybe a Moonstruck that has a great opera scene. But one of the films I dearly love is one I happened to on America Movie Classics or something one day, and it's called San Francisco.
Really?
And it's the old movie starring Clark Gable and Jeanette MacDonald, and it's where the song San Francisco, Open Your Golden Gates comes from. But in the movie, she goes from being a singing bar girl to being discovered by the opera, and there's wonderful scenes from La Traviata and Faust in it, and so some of those old black and whites, like the Harpo Marx or the Marx Brothers, Night at the Movies. There's a lot of great films in this.
So it sounds to me like you might have had to leave enough behind that you could do a chapter two or a chapter three down the road on this.
You absolutely could. I think that this is the cream of the crop, what we pulled out of here. I mean, it does. It runs the gamut from comedies to dramas, from old films to new films. Every major star you can think of is going to be on the screen at this show, you know.
Talk to me about structure. Are you trying to tell a story?
Well, we're going to have, we kind of will have sort of a thread through the whole night with an MC who's going to introduce.
That's Phil Van Hest,
right? Yeah, Phil Van Hest. And we're so glad to have him on board. He's coming out of left field for this crowd, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Many people in town know him as Phil the Void name of his brand from the Fringe Festivals. Yeah.
He is. He's hysterical, and he's intelligent, and he's related to an opera singer, a famous opera singer as well, so that helps us. Yeah. Do you remember what her name
is? I don't.
Oh, I don't remember. We'll have to ask Phil
no
that.
No worries.
But he is, and he's learning about opera as we go.
So is it the idea of, okay, so we're going to have an ingenue aria featured in one film, and then something is going to happen to move her story forward?
Yeah. Essentially, what we let the story sort of tell itself, and we decided to have an MC, which will be Phil Van Hest, and Phil the Void, as you might know from this show recently. He's going to kind of be our storyteller through the whole thing, and we've kind of broken up the whole show into segments. One segment might be a Mozart segment.
Okay.
And we might have a segment on one song that was used in two different films for two completely different feels.
Oh, fun.
We might have a song that was used in the same film twice for two completely different feels. And we've got all the segments kind of have a little story in and of itself. Or maybe it was an actor that we'll tag on to one particular segment, like Tim Robbins. We'll have two films with him in it, and they're back to back. So.
And we'll see clips from the film?
We will see clips set on a 40-foot wide screen, just like you're at the movies.
Whoa.
And these are the actual film clips from the actual movies. It's just going to be spectacular. And this is a one-of-a-kind production. I did a lot of research in who has ever done anything like this before from another opera company anywhere, and I have not found anybody that's done it like this.
Uh-oh.
They've actually gone out and got the clips and paid for the licensing and built the show.
And there's another cool aspect to this is Derek and Jim have worked together to the point that you may see the start of a film clip and the start of the music, and then Jim and he have figured out how to get it to then bleed down to the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra and the singers that we're bringing in for this production. So you'll see the transition from film to live. So that, you know, someone that likes film will find this fascinating and also get exposed to live, wonderful opera singing, and vice versa.
And vice versa.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, this could be your version of a Yuletide celebration, an idea that could be franchised,
Well, you never know. We've talked about all sorts of ideas going down that direction and have some wonderful singers coming in for it.
Back up for a second. I have to ask, because when you were talking about using all those clips, my first thought was, oh, my gosh, what a nightmare of licensing. How does that work? What do you have to do?
Well, that was one issue I looked at early on, because that's really going to be a deal. And it kind of breaks down to there are two companies that are kind of clearinghouses for most of the films that we're going to be using.
Huh.
I contacted the clearinghouses, and they have these rates, special rates. If you're only going to use a few minutes of a movie, you pay the rate, and there you go. And then probably half of them were through those companies, and then the other were I had to contact Warner Brothers and Universal Studios directly, and Zoetrope, who has Apocalypse Now, and they were all very, very, friendly with me, and they're just like, sure, you know, we do what we were to a rate. They gave me a quote, and we figured out if we could pay for it and managed to get the money together. And so, yeah, it was quite a process, but that's how you do it.
You know,
the arts are wonderful because no matter what project you take on in the performing arts, you always wind up learning something. And this has been one of those projects where we've all learned a lot from each other and about licensing and things like that.
You know, what would be really sweet is to figure out how to monitor Netflix requests after people come to this concert.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that would be cool.
Because you know people are going to go out and either go to the library and check out the DVD or
it's making me want to revisit some films I haven't seen in years.
How many how many soloists are involved in this?
We're bringing in 4 soloists and then using the Indianapolis Opera Chorus as well. We're bringing in Mark Thompson, a tenor who has sung at the Met and all over the country and has been a good friend of this company. Stella Zimbalis, who's been a local favorite, hasn't been with us, I think, since we did Turandot a few years ago.
She's dynamite.
But she's dynamite and has a great relationship with people. A young lady by the name of Rachel Gilmore, who you might recall literally stopped the show when we did Tales of Hoffman and Spotlight because with her mechanical doll aria that she went on then to cover at the Met and got on stage and had a wonderful debut with that role and has been asked back. And then Mark Gilgallon is the baritone who is local and has done a variety of roles for us. So those are the 4 soloists coming in to perform for with the orchestra and chorus.
I think I know the answer to this, but I want to ask, are they watching any of the film clips, or are they just treating it as a purely musical challenge?
The singers?
Yeah.
I'm sure they are. Jim has sent them all, you know, the music, of course, that they're going to be singing and performing, and probably what movie it was in. So perhaps they've gone and watched the clip itself. The movies, like, sometimes they will be singing with the movie going on behind them with the sound off, and then we're just hearing the live music, and sometimes they'll be coming in from the sound with the scene of the film going on, and they'll come out and continue the song that was live. I mean, it's going to be kind of an interesting mix and it's been quite a road trying to figure out how to make all that work. But
And once we get it logistically set up, we're going to be doing the thing that we did with the last production of this nature, which is live camera shots of the singers on the screen, which those people that typically sit in what we would call the cheap seats, which aren't cheap at all at Clues Hall. They're wonderful seats everywhere. But they'll get to see the singers performing in a way they're not used to because they'll be up on the screen. And people loved that last time.
You know, we might have some listeners who are still celebrating Valentine's Day with their sweetheart, and you have kind of a sweetheart deal going on.
We do have a sweetheart deal, and we extended it past Valentine's Day because we know that some people need that makeup gift, and we are supplying. We are supplying.
At whom are you looking,
or maybe
sir?
They found their Valentine on Valentine's Day and they want to do that. But anyway, it's a 2-for-1 special. We are offering it on both of our remaining operas, not just this opera Goes to the Movies, but also Faust, which is on May 4th and 6th. And all they have to do for this winter special is go to our website and Ticketmaster, and the promo code is winter, and we'll get them half-price tickets.
Sharon Gamble with Indianapolis Opera Executive Director John Pickett and Production Designer Derek Toe. You can see, and of course hear, excerpts from films including The Shawshank Redemption, Cape Fear, Citizen Kane, Atonement, The Blues Brothers, and many more. You can get your tickets and learn more at indieopera.org. Again, indieopera.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. As part of the 21st Annual Woodcarver and Turner Exhibit and Sale at Eagle Creek, more than a dozen woodcarvers from across the state will showcase a variety of artwork depicting wildlife, flora, and fauna, and or traditional Native Americans. Travis DiNicola spoke with woodworkers Ned Hugas and Jim Dupler about their work.
I've attended the woodcarvers exhibit and sale out at Eagle Creek a number of times. I have been always extremely impressed by the quality of the handiwork, the skill that goes into it, and so I'm really glad to have an opportunity to meet the two of you to talk about the work you do. Ned, if we will, let's start with you and tell me about how you got involved with exhibiting in this show.
Well, Travis, I retired about 20-some-odd years ago, And just prior to retiring, I visited a friend's garage sale. And I noticed he had a lathe. So back then, the lathe was quite old at that point, and I was getting quite old at that point. And so we combined at a good price, and I took the lathe home and jockeyed it down into the basement. And there it remained for a few years. And one day I decided to go down there and put a chunk of wood on, not knowing anything about turning.
Now, had you worked at all with wood when you were a kid, perhaps? Or?
Well, I've always enjoyed wood as a medium. And so that was somewhat of a natural for me. I've always thought wood opened up was a beautiful thing to behold, like a lot of things in our world. And so I just started crawling, so to speak, and throwing off a lot of pieces of wood in the interim. So
it sounds like probably learning a lot through that process.
Yes, yes. And I don't recommend this procedure for anyone, you know, thinking they're going in to go turning. They should have lessons from someone who is experienced.
So don't do what you do. But
no, don't do it like I did.
Jim, you've been doing it quite a while. I believe you've been in the business 50-some years now, right?
Pretty close, yes.
So now, did you have classes at all yourself, or are you also?
I did, you know, take some in high school. They were encouraged me to be a shop teacher, but my dad had been in the furniture business, so we had a whole shop full of tools at home, which he let me use from a very early age. And I did buy my first turning lathe, like I said, probably over 50 years ago when I was on my paper route. Saw one, went home, raided my piggy bank, and brought it home. So I started turning bowls. So that's always been a favorite of mine. But I've made my living building furniture and repairing furniture is what I've done for my livelihood. But I saw in the paper that they were having this wood carving, wood turning show at Eagle Creek. And after church one Sunday, we just stopped out there to see what was going on and met one of the other gentlemen there. Probably Ned was there, too, at the time, but another gentleman. We talked. We exchanged cards and numbers, and he called me later that summer for a collaborative project and then encouraged me to enter Eagle Creek show that following year, which is the first time I'd ever done a show. I'd always just given my turnings away. So so that was 9 years ago. So I've been doing it there ever since, and since entered several other shows. And currently sell my work at the CCA Gallery in Zionsville and also at the Artifacts Gallery in Broad Ripple and occasionally at the Indianapolis Museum of Art when their horticulturist gives me some of the wood off the grounds.
We'll, oh, that's great.
We'll make something out
it's
of it.
It's a neat opportunity, I'm sure.
Wood, and the people that work there are always fun to see their trees come back in an art form. That,
oh, of course.
Second life to it. So, so I do enjoy that part of it.
Now, the work that you two do, and I want to get back to that sort of that second life idea, but do each of you have a specialty as far as a type of thing, whether it's a box or carve animals or a certain style that that you are more known for, perhaps?
Probably lidded boxes.
I
do
boxes
mostly little boxes with lids. I've done some high-end ones that have been in national syndicated magazines and have sold upwards of $1,000 or so. But most of mine are more in the $30, $40 range, nice little boxes that are functional but also artistic.
Okay. And Ned, how about you?
Well, I haven't compared to Jim. I'm probably still in kindergarten.
Don't believe that. But
I don't do a lot of small turnings. I like to get in a piece of wood in a robust way and throw chips, that sort of thing, and then try to put a design on the things, on the bowls, or carve some things. I've done
And the turning, I want to clarify a couple of things here, because when you say throw chips, that just doesn't sound safe at all. But the turning process itself on a lathe, I mean, basically it's a very fast-moving saw sort of moving in a circular manner, right? That's cutting through. I'm trying to visualize this for our radio listeners here.
Sure. It is a very safe form of woodworking, where most other woodworking involves metal blades or metal things spinning, here you have the sharp metal chisel in your hand, both hands, and just the wood itself is moving.
The wood itself is moving, and you're holding the chisel that's making that pattern. Now, when you say throw chips, what do you mean by that?
Well, as you use your instruments on the bowl, it's turning very fast on the lathe, and you have protection over your face.
Sure.
And you just throw a lot of wood chips.
Sounds like you're making a mess.
Yes, they accumulate feet thick on the floor. It's amazing how much you can accumulate from one piece of wood.
And you both often work in, I mean, sort of, it's one piece of wood at a time. It's not pieces that are glued together necessarily or adhered.
No, that is another form of woodturning. They call it segmented, and it is a whole other art form again. I personally don't do much of that, but it is beautiful work that people do with that.
But what you're saying, and this is what I wanted to get back to, that sense of giving, you know, a tree a second life. Ned, you sort of alluded to it a little bit earlier, sort of discovering things within the work. One thing that I've heard often from other people who work in wood, who I've had a chance to talk with, different artists who've worked in wood, is that it seems like more than almost any other medium, there's really an opportunity of discovery in the process of creating whatever work that you are working on, that you may have an image in mind when you start, but as you start actually working the wood, carving the wood, sawing the wood, that you start discovering things within the wood that changes maybe how you approach it and the shape. And
yeah, we call it design opportunities sometimes when you are working on a piece. Sometimes you do make a mistake.
Design frustrations, maybe.
Yeah, and things don't always work as what you had in your mind, but sometimes the piece that evolves from that is better than what you had in mind, you know, sometimes due to a flaw in the wood or a flaw in your workmanship, you know. But
yes, I enjoy opening that wood and seeing the various textures and what nature has pronounced, so to speak, you know, as the tree is growing. Depends a lot of factors.
Now, one of the things that I also really like about the show that takes place at Eagle Creek is that not only is it a great show of work in wood, but it's for the most part, most of the artwork really does depict different, whether it's wildlife or animals, or there's a great sense of nature in the subject matter, not just the material itself. Yeah. It's sort of something special about this show.
Yes, there is. There are a lot of very talented carvers there that do carve beautiful birds and animals and things out of wood that they quite often find. A gentleman comes up from southern Indiana that pulls driftwood out of the Ohio River and turns it into just beautiful pieces that just come alive out of the driftwood. So
they really do. I remember going a couple of years ago and seeing a couple birds, especially that were carved out of wood. That I, you know, there's that moment where you can't even imagine that something that looks so delicate and light could be made of wood.
Right, and it just takes a lot of extra patience and skill, and a lot of hard work to get that to happen. Sometimes,
sure,
but it's a labor of love. Sometimes you so often people ask, you know, are you making any money out of it? Well, you don't really think of it as that. You put the hours in until you get it finished.
Sure.
And that's just, I figured I could be reading a book or watching TV or playing golf. It's my hobby and passion also. Mm-hmm. So, it's fun just to see what you can create. And if you happen to sell it, that's a plus.
Absolutely.
So. I have a very, very small, as a matter of fact, it's the smallest owl in existence. And it is called the sawhet. And this little owl is only about 3.5 inches tall and a couple inches wide. And it was done by a friend of mine, a carver. and it looks, for all purposes, a live bird. And it's just a beauty to behold. Colors, it painted exactly the way the little owl in nature is.
And work like that just astounds me. And it sounds like there's such an interesting variety of the work that's going to be shown at this exhibit and sale as well. And it is a sale, and that's something important to mention. Woodcarver and Turner exhibit and sale. It's the 21st annual taking place at the Earth Discovery Center at Eagle Creek Park. One thing I want to ask you both, sort of a last question, if you will, for our interview. Jim, you mentioned earlier having the opportunity to use some wood that came off the grounds of the IMA. Is there a favorite spot for you to find wood, or maybe some place where you've always wanted to get wood from to make something out of? And I'll ask the same of you in a moment, Ned.
Not really. Just they did give me some hawthorn that came off the grounds of the IMA. They said it was the oldest and largest hawthorn tree in the state, and it lightning or something blew down.
Yeah.
So I was able to get several good chunks of it. It was just a beautiful, deep, dark red wood. I had never had a chance to use it. I was just enthralled once I got into it, and they were very happy to get some of it back.
That's a very special opportunity.
Right, it was. Huh. And if I could just add one last thing, I'd be remiss about the Eagle Creek Park. One of the highlights of it that keeps us exhibitors coming back every year is that the volunteers and the staff of the park provide us a very nice breakfast and lunch those 2 days. And we all say that even if we don't sell anything, it's worth coming there just for the delicious homemade food and hospitality that the staff provides for us exhibitors there. So it's always
good,
a highlight
very good
for
to
us.
Know.
So,
excellent.
And if you come out there, maybe we can slip you a cookie or two.
Keep that in mind. Ned, I'll ask you the same question. Is there any particular wood you really enjoy working with, or wood from a specific location, or maybe some type of wood you'd like to work with?
Well, of course, it goes without saying hardwoods are the best to work with. That's for a lot of reasons. But I'll not go into that, but I had the opportunity to get a lot of this wood that Jim just talked about out at the Indianapolis Art Museum, and they wanted to buy some articles made from this wood taken from the site. So I made them about a dozen bowls of various sorts of wood and dimensions. Took it out, and they bought the articles to sell in their shop.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
Very good. That's excellent. I'll have to chat with Mark Zalonis sometime to find out more about his end of that story. But the gentleman who directs the Old Fields and the Grounds there at the IMA. I want to thank both of you, Jim and Ned, for coming out today to Art of the Matter. And I look forward to seeing you at the show out at Eagle Creek just in about a week or so. Thank you both.
Thank you. We enjoyed
thank
it.
You.
Travis DiNicola with woodworkers Ned Hugas and Jim Dupler. The 21st annual Woodcarver and Turner exhibit and sale at Eagle Creek in the Earth Discovery Center takes place on Saturday, February 25th and Sunday, February 26th from 9 to 5 both days. Admission is free with paid car admission to Eagle Creek Park. In addition to having work for sale, artists will demonstrate how they create their various works and talk with visitors about their craft. A children's area will also be available where kids can try their hand at carving bars of soap with various kid-friendly tools. More information is available at eaglecreekpark.org, eaglecreekpark.org. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
You know that there's this new trend, this new holiday trend, where people are celebrating not just Valentine's Day, but Valentine's Week, right?
Oh, of course, of course.
So I think
it's never too late, especially if you forgot on
that's
Tuesday.
Right.
Right. Or if maybe your spouse works in, as say, as a florist or right. or a chocolatier.
And they were too tired
they
to celebrate.
They were too tired so to celebrate.
You've got some ideas?
We'll have some lovely ideas for you and your sweethearts on our calendar we call.
What do we do? Never too late.
That's right.
So here's an interesting play that the Phoenix Theater is opening this weekend, runs through March 11th, titled August, A Sage County by Tracy Letts. It was the winner of Best Play, the 2008 Tony Award and Pulitzer. And it's a dark comedy, sort of dealing with dark family secrets. I've heard it described as a, well, if you took a long day's journey in tonight and made it into a dark comedy, which makes me want to go see it. Just the idea of something like that, that certainly makes your family look normal based on what's on stage. And this opens this weekend at the Phoenix Theater. Should be a lot of fun.
I'm deeply sorry, Mr. O'Neill. Hey, if the name Janice Siegel sounds familiar, you probably have some Manhattan Transfer albums in your collection.
Oh, yeah.
She is coming to town as part of a concert tour called New York Standard Time, courtesy of the Cabaret at the Columbia Club. She'll be here on February 24th and 25th at 8 o'clock. And what a lovely evening. She's a great entertainer, great songstress, and it'll be fun to hear her without her compatriots in Manhattan Transfer. Janice Siegel, February 24th and 25th, Cabaret at the Columbia Club.
You know, if you missed some of the First Friday activities, I mean, that was only 2 weeks ago, but that was that Super Bowl weekend. Seems like
Super Bowl.
What was that? Yeah.
Bowl.
Well,
yeah.
there was so much going on that weekend that I know a lot of people missed some of the gallery openings. Just a reminder, at the Harrison Center, there's still a great exhibit of Mark Jacobson's work, one of the first exhibits of his work locally in a number of years. And this is actually at the City Gallery. Mark's an amazing painter. He paints these beautiful cityscapes, often parking lots, which sounds kind of odd, but they're just really amazing work. He's also a professor at Heron, and this exhibit is on through the end of the month at the City Gallery, as well as some other exhibits, including the Super Bowl exhibit that is also at the Harrison Center. Definitely worth checking out.
Cool. There are great performances showcased at the Arts Garden this month as part of the Art and Soul Celebration,
oh, yeah.
including one this Sunday afternoon by Governor Davis and the Blues Ambassadors at 1 o'clock, High Energy Blues Classics and Originals. Then on Monday, take a late lunch and head over to the Arts Garden at 2 o'clock for performances by the Asante Children's Theater, song, dance, and spoken word performances.
This is kind of a really interesting performance that is, I mean, taking place at Franklin College at the Custer Theater there. Coming up on Tuesday, the 21st, it's titled Nobody Needs to Know, and it's a one-act play about disarming the stigma of mental illness, and it actually stars a cast of consumers of mental health services. It's free. It's open to the public. It's supported by Franklin College's Counseling Center, and it's a production of the Awareness of Mental Health through the Performing Arts Organization, and it's also sponsored through NAMI of Indianapolis. Very interesting. Taking place again at Franklin College, 7 p.m., coming up on Tuesday night. Definitely worth checking out.
Excellent. Very good. Let's see. I have something fun going on at Booth Tarkington Civic Theater. It's Ooh. Lend Me a Tenor, the Ken Ludwig farce production, and just a lot of fun. There's a grand opera company that faces imminent ruin when its star accidentally takes an overdose of tranquilizers and can't perform. And of course, somebody swoops in to save the day. And there's
swoops,
and there's all sorts of shenanigans because that's what a farce is all about.
I like shenanigans.
Lend Me a Tenor. Oh, shenanigans. Mm-hmm. St. Patrick's Day isn't far away. Lend Me a Tenor up at Booth Tarkington Civic Theater through February 25th.
Hey, concert going on this weekend. On Sunday, the Philharmonic Orchestra of Indianapolis is having their annual gospel concert, and it is taking place at 2:15 at the Pike Performing Arts Center, and along with a whole bunch of other great performances, they're also featuring fifth grade students who will be singing with them. The gospel choir from IPS Combined Schools 56 and 57. So that should be a lot of fun with those students joining the Philharmonic Choir out at the Pike Performing Arts Center for an afternoon of gospel.
School 57, George Julian School on Washington Street, not far from where you live, Travis.
Very good. Well, Sharon, we will be back next week with more ideas of great things to do for your sweetheart or just anyone else and checking out the art scene in Indy on the calendar we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
In design circles, Sharon's next guest is nicknamed Mr. Color. He's Carlton Varney, who is one of the country's best-known interior designers, and he's coming to Indianapolis for a talk and book signing during the Indianapolis Art and Antique Show at the Indiana State Fairgrounds on Friday, March 9th.
Give us a little insight into how the world of design grabbed onto you, or you onto it.
Well, you know, I'm a person who believes in destiny.
Really?
And I think it's all already in the motion of the air, what happens to you. I think we get on a road, we work hard in life, but for what we are doing. But we get on this road, and you get crossroads all the time.
Sure.
The cross street. You can take a left or a right or keep going straight. And it really happened when I was growing up, you know, when I was younger and I was a student at the University of Madrid and I was this Oberlin College graduate and so forth. I always thought I would end up being the ambassador to Spain.
Really?
So if you look at the New York Times they did on me last Thursday in the home section, it's a full page and it's a Q&A. I talk about that, that I do believe it's destiny. And I never thought when I was in school that I would end up here at Dorothy Draper and Company for almost 45 years. And I have. But Dorothy used to say, Mrs. Draper used to say, who was an icon in this industry and in this world, the name Dorothy Draper is synonymous with what Coco Chanel was to fashion. Dorothy Draper in America was to interior decorating and decoration. And her name, she licensed everything. Hmm. And this, of course, was in she started the business in 1923. And, you know, she had been married to George Draper, who was President Roosevelt's private physician at Campobello. So there's a history here. An enormous history. And Mrs. Draper used to walk around this office and go to the boards of the different decorators. And we were working on a hotel or an aircraft or whatever we were doing. And she would say, rolling her hands, she would say, "Show me nothing that looks like gravy." So when she saw fabrics that had anything that touched on the look of what was gravy, she hated. So the idea of this office and its success, really, is the fact that we do color better than anyone. I really mean that, because people are afraid of color.
What? And that was the main question I wanted to ask you. Why are Americans afraid of color? You periodically say...
Not that they originally were. When we're young and we have finger paints like a child, we start finger painting. We mix we learn that you mix a primary color, like you mix yellow and red and you create orange, or you mix blue and red and create purple, and you mix yellow with blue and you make green. So children in today's world never learn that. And then I went on my life, then I went on to Crayolas, where crayon colors became very important, and then filling in the lines. Then in the 60s, I did a lot of painting, and I became like, like Jackson Pollock, but never quite in his league. But I did have shows, and many people bought my paintings. Then when I got into the world of color, I learned by coming here the magic of color. And people ask me what my favorite color is. And I say my favorite color is green. And People magazine once did a story on me when they said, and his favorite color is green, yes, the color of money.
No.
Money was never, ever an object for me.
The color of nature.
The color of nature was never, only because people were paying us so much money to do things, they thought that green related to the fact that this company has been very successful since 1909. We are the oldest established design and decorating firm in the nation. And it was founded by Mrs. Draper. And the thing about it is that while we're the oldest, at one time we were had the youngest staff.
Hmm.
And we've continually gone on. And of course we do fabulous properties like the Greenbrier in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia. Our office and I, we are the curators of that property. And that property is the last resort in America that still has glamour. When we did the Dorothy Draper design exhibition at Fifth Avenue, the Museum of the City of New York, and then the show traveled to Dallas, to the Women's Museum, and then it went on to Fort Lauderdale, to the Fine Art Museum there. When the show was in process, and throughout the times, 300,000 people went through that show. And it was a presentation of the magic of Dorothy Draper, because Dorothy was not a person who was necessarily renowned for her decorating while she was a decorator. Dorothy Draper was known because she could create a look. She created a look that's identifiable, and that is American Baroque. And just like Frank Lloyd Wright created a look, you'll always know a Frank Lloyd Wright house. And Taliesin, which is his museum in Arizona, shows the detail of how this was done. Dorothy Draper's look, we're doing in a museum at White Sulphur Springs on the grounds of the Greenbrier. It will be known as the Dorothy Draper Museum.
Hmm.
And people come, and if you pull up, if on a website, the name Dorothy Draper gets 2,500 hits a day.
Wow.
And what was it that made her synonymous, an icon? When I was doing the show in New York, we were doing the museum and I, they did their own curating, but I listened to some young people who were standing on the steps of this beautiful edifice on Fifth Avenue with a flag of her face 60 feet long.
Wow.
In the air over the museum.
Wow.
And they were looking at her face, and I finally realized what all these young people, why they were so fascinated. Because Dorothy Draper represented something that they never knew, and that's a thing called glamour.
Mm.
Because all of this generation and previous earlier generations, they have grown up in the world of bentwood chairs and brick walls and white tablecloths and white china cafeteria. They never knew how pretty it would be to have a rim of pink around the border.
You might have just explained why the most popular color for exterior paint on houses in this country is still white, which makes me crazy.
Well, you know, it is all about color. And I have a school of design we're doing at the Greenbrier Hotel, which is called the Dorothy Draper Design School, which we have a week's program so many times during the season.
Mm-hmm.
And then students can come in for several a day or two and take from these things. what they learn. It isn't to make them full class decorators. It's only to make people aware of how they can improve their life with color. Most people don't even know how to hang a picture. They don't understand how to a wall surface, whether you put a mirror in the middle and two brackets with figurines in it. They don't know how to do an ensemble on a wall properly. They don't understand the magic of doing bedscapes, how to make a bed beautiful, how to lay the pillow, whether it's necessary to have a spread. It's not about spreads. It's about how to set and we do it on tables too, tablescapes.
It's about the tableau.
It is, and everything is a choice. You know, many people, this generation is into the world of television dinners. Throw it into the thing, warm it up, and serve it.
And they pace in front of the microwave and go, hurry, hurry, hurry.
You know, they don't understand, they don't know the beauty of glamour.
So you're giving people not only a little bit of technique, but more importantly, some permission and some courage.
We're giving them an inside thing to know the things, the steps in school that they never had. They don't teach penmanship anymore.
No.
I don't hire anybody here who doesn't have a beautiful penmanship.
That's fantastic.
And I mean it, too. I don't have them White House scripting. I mean, I was the White House decorator in the Carter administration.
Right.
And I don't make them do hand calligraphy.
Sure.
That isn't what we hire people to do that. Although at the White House we had a calligrapher. It's all about caring. And when I talk to my students at the University of Charleston or at the Draper School, one of the first things I have them do is simply write me an essay about the very first room you remember.
Ooh.
And carry it back in your head. What do you remember about that room? Who was in the room? What was the fragrance in the room? What did it smell like, an apple pie your grandmother made? Or did the room have lots of windows? Did those windows look out to the sea? Did they look out to the mountains? Did they look like out to a backyard with a string of laundry on lines? Or did they look out to brick walls? Was there any sound in the room? Was it a hard surface floor, or did it have a rug on the floor? What was the color of the room? You remember what the lights were like? Tell me was there a picture in the room? What was hung at the windows? Were they Venetian blinds? Were they draw draperies? I want you to tell me everything you remember in about 600 to 1,200 words. And then, after you write the essay, I want you to draw me a picture of the room. Use a pencil. Use a pen, use crayons, use ink, water, color, whatever you want to do. But you cannot use a CAD machine. Because I do not believe in CAD machines. Because you cannot personalize in a floor plan, and we don't do CAD drawings here anymore. Because CAD machines are pressing buttons where you pull out a generic chair and drop it into place and put a sofa 7 feet long or 8 foot long. But you can't personalize the plan. You can't put in a beautiful plant in this corner. You can't detail how a round table would look next to the... It has to be hand-drawn. And hand-drawing is the only way that you can get a person, a human being, on the drawing. Because we are not machines. So therefore, when they finish this drawing, we keep all of them, and with their techniques and their look at perspective, eye to hand to motor controls, I can make my people look wonderful.
Mm.
Because that is a trainable part. But it is the essay that is the most important thing, because I believe that in the essay is the beginning of your taste. And I don't believe there is good taste or bad taste. There is only taste. And I have had movie stars from Crawford to Merriman to Van Johnson to Joe Namath, and I've had prime ministers, and I've had heads of state, and I've had presidents and vice presidents and ambassadors and moguls in business, and I always have got to get back to the very first room they remember. Because in your life, you carry that through the steps, and because I don't believe there is good taste or bad taste, and I believe the taste is like fog. You look at the sea and the fog rolls in. You can see the fog and you can feel the fog against your body, but you can never touch it. So what is happy for living with one person is not a formula. None of us are machines. None of us are formulas. And to make a happy world and a happy self, you have to know what was in that very first room and who you are.
Sharon Gamble with Mr. Color, Carlton Varney. Mr. Varney is featured in a talk and book signing followed by a luncheon during the Indianapolis Art and Antique Show at the Indiana State Fairgrounds on Friday, March 9th. The show has many special events and appearances, including one by Carrie Cuxey of HGTV's Cash and Carry. The show features 80 artists, galleries, antique dealers, and designers, and takes place Friday, March 9th through Sunday, March 11th. It benefits the Methodist Hospital Task Corps. You can learn more at methodisthealthfoundation.org/antique show. Let me say that again, methodisthealthfoundation.org/antiques show. And that antiques is plural, so there's two S's there.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4, when I'll get a preview of the National Touring Company production of Fiddler on the Roof.
Dun, 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 dun.
I'll talk with Tevia.
Yeah, I love that. I'll chat with a theater organist who's coming to town.
And I'll find out about a one-man show called RFK Remember. Plus, there'll be our arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.